The following lecture was delivered at the 17th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Palm Desert, California, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Rabbi Dr. Saul Chaimoff now presents his lecture, Where Mitzvot Meet Mental Health.
I think today's day and age with the internet and social media, one of the biggest challenges we face as mental health professionals is the information that's out there that is not always from a reliable source. And people are getting information from influencers who are very charismatic and have a great way of presenting information in a pithy, you know, bite-sized, social media-friendly way. And people are eating it up, and that's wonderful. There's so much great content. I follow many mental health professionals on Instagram as well. But sometimes we don't know where the information is coming from. We don't know what the source is, and we don't know if it's accurate or even healthy. So one thing I really try to emphasize is know where you're getting the information from. Who is speaking to you? What are their credentials? What is their experience? And what is the evidence to support their claims? So as Zalmi mentioned, I feel that I wear two hats, or I'm able to straddle these two worlds. One in the world of Jewish community, Jewish education, being a rabbi ordained from Yeshiva University, and serving in several roles where I still serve as the program director and associate rabbi of the Jewish Center for Atlantic Beach. So I'm a long way from home across the country. That's Atlantic Beach, New York. As well as a clinical psychologist, went to Long Island University, and I have a private practice where I specialize in treating children, adolescents, and young adults, or those who feel young at heart, with anxiety and behavioral disorders as a specialty. And I'm not here to promote my book or to sell books. I didn't even know they were bringing, and I'm not even involved in the business aspect of it. I am just very passionate about the work that Dr. David Rosemary and I put into this for several years, researching extensively the area of Torah and mental health. So much of the sources I'm gonna bring today are in this book. I brought one copy as a demonstration, but of course, if you're interested, you can feel free to purchase. Again, that is not my agenda. It's just something that I'm very proud of, and many people have given me feedback that they find it very meaningful and helpful as well. I'll backtrack for a second. The general philosophy that many spiritual people have, especially in the Jewish faith, is that everything comes from God. Not only does God run the world, he created the world, and our blueprint, the Torah, our not just our book, but our tradition, our culture, has so much wisdom in it. There's so much to learn that's timeless, there's truth in there, and even there are hints, sources, sometimes more direct, sometimes less direct, to things that were not discovered, truth that were not discovered till many, many centuries later in the world of science. And one of the things I do when I write an inscription is I write the phrase from the Mishnah of Pirkei Avot, the ethics of our fathers, hafachba ve'afachba dekuloba, which means turn it over, dive into it, research it over and over again, for everything is contained within it. And I truly believe that the Torah is a source of all wisdom, and it contains universal and eternal truths. So what is so nice and fascinating and meaningful for people is to see these two worlds bridged and not just complement each other, but harmonize each other. So we'll be wavering or toggling back and forth between Torah sources and psychology sources together, putting it all together. So let's talk about God. I gave a talk, or actually a training, to the entire Department of Psychology and Psychiatry at Northwell Health. If you're from New York, anyone from the East Coast, do we have any East Coast representation here? Okay, so if you're, all right, in the house. If you're familiar with the East Coast, especially the tri-state area, Northwell Health, formerly known as Long Island Jewish, is a conglomerate, a hospital system that has buildings and offices all around the tri-state area. And I gave this presentation a few years ago on training the psychologists and psychiatrists there on how to integrate religion and spirituality into practice, into mental health practice. It's a very daunting task. And we'll see that God, religion, is kind of taboo. It's not always accepted. It's a weighted word, and it triggers positive and sometimes negative emotions in people, and that's something we want to flesh out and bring out and address, because it is a very powerful experience to have God in your life. So as you can see from these various research studies, Americans and really the world at large are a religious people. People overwhelmingly believe in God, believe in some type of universal spirit or force, practice religion regularly. We are religious people, and it's on our dollar bill, in God we trust. So God is alive and well in American culture and world culture at large. That is the general populace. And for good reason. There is such a benefit, research tried and tested positive benefits of belief in God. There are dozens and dozens of studies that over and over again confirm and support the notion that religiosity, religious practice and belief, is associated with positive well-being. So why is that? We're going to talk a little bit about that today, how that works and why it works. But it's important to know that religion is very powerful, it's very effective, it's very positive, and it's a strong source of support for many, many people in the world. And a big part of that is believing in a force, believing in a God, believing that the world is not random. Things don't just happen out of a coincidence. Everything is for a reason. There's a plan. There's someone in charge. Gives people a sense of comfort, gives people a sense of meaning, a sense of happiness and satisfaction. The question I ask all of my clients in my practice as part of the intake process is, what is your reason for waking up in the morning? Can you answer that question? I'll ask very practically, what is your reason for waking up today? Why did you get out of bed and start your day today? You have to be able to answer that question every single day, either consciously or subconsciously. Sometimes I'll get a referral for a teenage boy. The mother will call me all panicky, saying, doctor, he's depressed. He's in bed all day. I don't see him. He's in his room. I don't know what he's doing there for hours and hours. It's very concerning. So I'll meet with him, this young man, and I'll ask him, what is your reason for waking up this morning? Because many times, especially in the summer, teenage boys, young men and women, they're off. They have no school. They have no camp. They have no responsibilities. They have no commitments in their schedule. Sometimes their only appointment for the whole week is their session with me. And I'll say, of course they're not waking up in the morning. Why would they? They have no reason to get out of bed. What's the difference if they sleep till 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock? It makes no difference to them. So don't put the pressure on them and don't put the expectation on them that they have to wake up in the morning. They need a reason to wake up in the morning, and that could only come from them, from inside. It can't come from you, the mom. It can't come from me, the therapist, or the rabbi. I could help them find it, and together we have to discover what is their reason for waking up in the morning. So everyone can feel grateful and alive that, thank God, we all woke up this morning, and we're going to have a meaningful, impactful day. And in Judaism, we celebrate that, and we acknowledge that with a very simple phrase, which many people have the practice of saying every morning, Mode ani lefanecha melechai v'kayam, shechazarta bi nishmati v'chemla rabba munatecha. I'll translate. It's in essence, thank you, Hashem. Thank you, God, for giving me a new day, giving me my soul back, and giving me a reason to live my life. So that is religion, spirituality. Judaism is our reason for waking up. For many other people, a family, a job, volunteering, or just a pet or errands, you have a reason to get up in the morning. Religion gives us that reason, and that in and of itself is the best benefit we could ask for. It's our purpose, it's our reason for being alive. Now we go to psychology, okay? Historically, the evolution of psychology, it has not been very friendly to religion. Interestingly enough, we write in the introduction to our book, and I've presented on the history of psychology and Judaism. Many of the founding fathers of psychology were from the tribe. They're one of us. Many, overwhelmingly so. In fact, the Nazis burned Freud's books. They called it the Jew science. Right? Freud was not a practicing Jew. He was not even, as you can see from many, many of his quotes, he was not even very fond of religion. And yet, to our enemies who hate us, it was Jewish enough for them, right? Judaism and psychology are intimately intertwined. But yet, psychologists overwhelmingly not only are not religious and atheists, but may have a negative or critical opinion about religion. As you can see from a recent study done in 2007, whereas in the general public, 72%, almost 3 out of 4 people say that my whole life is based on religion, only 35% of psychologists reported so. And even more so in a critical way, religion is not very important in my life, almost half of psychologists endorse that belief. So it is very important as psychologists to provide, there's a buzzword, culturally competent treatment. Right, we need to be able to treat people from different cultures, and we need to be able to understand their culture, understand their symptomology in the context of their culture, and really validate and respect their cultural beliefs. So in giving trainings, that is the goal of the training, is to create or to improve, right, the cultural competency of mental health practitioners. Because as you could see, there's a good chance if you're meeting someone from the general public, religion is going to be important in their life. So today is all about, again, creating that bridge, creating the commonality between religion and mental health. And we're going to get to some specific sources and ideas in just a minute. I want to be clear. Sometimes I get challenged with a question from the crowd. If they view me as the type of rabbi who is going to impose religion and have an agenda, religious agenda, as a practitioner, as a professional, they will accuse me of injecting my values and religion into the therapy room when it's not appropriate. And of course, that is 100% correct, that is unethical and inappropriate for any therapist to impose their political views, their religious views, or even their cultural views onto the client. We have to remain neutral, and we have to fully support our therapist. This is a common question that comes up in Jewish forums about what do you do as a Jewish therapist if your client is engaging in things that are against Torah law, or perhaps part of their treatment recommendation might be for them to violate some of the Jewish laws. That's an interesting question, but I want to be very clear that my philosophy and the goal, I believe, of integrating spirituality and therapy is to use the therapeutic techniques that we already are trained in, right? Whether it's evidence-based practice in the field of the orientation of cognitive behavioral therapy, or psychodynamic or psychoanalysis orientations, we're doing regular therapy. Therapy as we were trained in our schooling, our backgrounds, our clinical experiences. But if we have a way of relating it, a technique or intervention or an idea, a theory, to something that is meaningful to the client's life, well, that's a bonus, right? That you know, it could be sports, it could be music, it could be art, it could be religion, it could be the Torah. In fact, some of my favorite sessions are with religiously inclined, spiritual people, observant people, and we are able to discuss the weekly Torah portion or a holiday coming up in relation to what they're going through in their real life experience. And that makes it meaningful, and if they're spiritually inclined, it makes it almost supernatural. It's a really powerful, incredible experience to be able to do that, and in order to do that, you have to be well-versed in both of these areas. So some highlights of religious coping, how religious practice and belief helps people improve their mental health or specifically treat symptoms of mental illness. Just a smorgasbord, if you will, a charcuterie board of some ideas, and I'm sure many people have others. I'm always collecting new sources and new connections. So we're going to talk about faith and trust in God as a coping mechanism, a sense of meaning and purpose, prayer and mindfulness, social support, and finally specific CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, and DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy, techniques and strategies that could be framed or taught with a religious or Jewish context. Okay, so here we go, everyone. So 101 in mental health is anxiety, right? There's no person who does not experience any anxiety ever in their life. We've all experienced that feeling of being worried, being nervous, being scared, being anxious. It's not a pleasant feeling, but of course it is a part of the human emotion, the human range of emotions. So researchers and theorists have described anxiety as the doubting disease. And specifically, it is the intolerance of uncertainty. One's ability to tolerate uncertainty is directly related to their symptoms of anxiety. What does that mean? I'll give you an example. Right now, I'm very anxious, not just about speaking to a full room, but because in a few hours, I have to catch a plane from LAX back to New York in order to make it on time for my shul dinner tomorrow. Now, besides for it being the shul dinner, which I would be obligated to go to anyway as one of the rabbis, my wife happens to be being honored this year as the Eshet Chayil Award, the Woman of Valor, and I'm supposed to give an introduction. No, this is not for, but thank you. It's well-deserved and long overdue. But if I don't make it back, I'm fired and I'm divorced. God forbid. But I'm very anxious about it, and there's been many flight delays, and I hear horror stories about air travel, and I am very anxious about making it there on time. I'm in there, exactly. That is me. I'm speaking to myself. I practice what I preach. I know fully well what anxiety feels like. And I sometimes try to coach myself, self-talk, and say, you know, Saul, this is, okay, faith. Emuna, bitachon, trust in God. It's all going to work out. It's all part of the plan. I don't know. It just, for some reason, it's not working. Okay, I just can't. I do believe, I am optimistic it's going to work out, and yet I still feel anxious. So how does this work? How can we help ourselves and help others with this incredible superpower we have in our repertoire? So I don't know if you've ever learned Jewish philosophy or taken an intro to Judaism class, you'll hear all these words that start with omni, omnipresent, omnibenevolent, right? Omni. It all means that God is all-knowing, God is all-powerful, God is good, God has a plan. I try to put this in progression. Everything happens for a reason, and it's all for the good, right? Meaning we have various levels of faith in God. And all those levels could build on each other to the point that you believe that the universe is not random, everything happens for a reason, that reason is a good reason, and it's a part of a specific individualized plan for you that this all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-loving creature has decided. And that is the essence of faith and trust in God. And the way that it works clinically and scientifically, we were able to boil it down. I try to create a graphic to illustrate this complicated process. But basically, you have an ambiguous situation, an unknown. Am I going to make the plane? I don't know. Am I going to get the job? Are they going to email me back? Is she going to say yes to a date? Or perhaps, and I apologize, trigger warning for medical issues, but you know, as a rabbi and a therapist, the most anxiety-provoking and upsetting, disturbing news someone could have, perhaps, in terms of their health, is they go to a checkup and the doctor says, I see something I don't like. I'm a bit concerned about this mass. We have to do some testing, some biopsies, and to see if it's malignant or benign. And you have to wait to get those results. That is torture. That is awful. Waiting and waiting and waiting and playing out the scenarios in your mind and all kinds of doomsday, worst case, horrible nightmare scenarios that are just so real and vivid in your imagination. And until you have that certainty, those results, that confirmation, you can't feel at ease. You can't feel calm. In Judaism, we have a phrase for this. It's in the book. It was hard to find. Speaking about sources, one of the most difficult tasks of authoring the book together was finding the original sources. I had to see it with my own eyes. People would tell me, oh, yes, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, he said something about this once. Where? Which sikha? Which mimer? I got to find it. I need to see it to make sure it's really there because it's going in a book, and we need to cite it. So, Ein simcha ke'atarsa sveikos is a phrase in Judaism. There is no greater joy than the resolution of doubt. Anyone know where that is, where that source is found? A lot of people quote it. Anyone heard that before? A lot of people quote it. No one really knows where it is. It's in a very minor, not so well-known Jewish source. I won't give it away, but there is there is a source out there that does say, "Ein simcha k'taras ha-sveikos," which means there is no greater joy than resolution of doubt, which means that the greatest happiness, or if I could interpret it differently as menuchat ha-nefesh, peace of mind, serenity, calmness, is when we don't have doubt. But the world is filled with doubts all the time. So our ability to tolerate that, to cope with that, will be directly related to our feelings of anxiety. So again, in this graphic over here, you have the ambiguous situation. That's what we call the trigger, the unknown future. And the circle says trust in God. Someone has trust in God. Then they have greater tolerance of uncertainty because they have a lack of power and no control. Right? Let go and let God. Do your rest and God will do the best. Pick your favorite Instagram post. And if they really believe that and they could really internalize that and integrate that into their psyche, into their being, the end result is they will have decreased worry. It's not random. What is meant to be will be. They will feel more at ease. Okay. And this was done in studies. They actually did an experimental design. And they had a group of religious individuals, Christians and Jews, and they did a baseline rating of their belief in God. They fill out some surveys, questionnaires. By the way, if you ever have the opportunity to do one of those studies, you see it from a reputable source, please do it. Please fill it out. It really helps with research. The more participants you have, the greater your power of your statistical results. It really helps. Sometimes they're time-consuming, I know. But if it's a reputable source, a researcher, a practitioner that you know and recognize that's doing a study, especially on religion and spirituality, these results are fascinating. So what they found is that as they improved in their trust of God, they watched their favorite inspirational videos, Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson, Rabbi Manus Freeman, pick your favorite inspiration, Rabbi Shmuel Reichman, and they watched those videos and they felt an increase in trust in God, they had less anxiety after many weeks of the study. So we know that it works and it can be done, and it's so important for our mental health and well-being to be able to improve our faith. And this is science. This is not religion. This is actual, I can't call it fact, evidence to support this claim. The serenity prayer, right? This is what it all comes down to. God grant me the serenity. Any people have this poster hanging up in their office or their, be proud. Okay, this is probably one of the most common signs that people have. My mother is a psychologist. We share an office together. She's been practicing for over 40 years. I learned everything I know from her, and she has this sign up hanging in our office together. So biblical verses, prayers, right? Narratives. I talk a lot about biblical narratives, stories from our Torah, from our Tanakh, from our Bible, going to classes, support groups, religious services, guidance from religious leaders, individuals, rabbayim, right, rabbis, and of course, spiritually informed psychotherapy. Many times people who come to therapy, and sometimes they are referred to me because they are, one of their issues of concern is lack of faith, lack of practice, feeling burnt out, questioning, or actively engaging in things that are against Jewish belief and culture. And they want to talk about it. They want to talk to me as a rabbi, but I don't wear the rabbi hat, right? I wear the therapist hat. I don't wear a hat anyway. And we talk about religion, what it means to them, and what is their relationship with God like? You know, what is God, how do they make sense of the world of suffering? And in that process of discovering their truth, their mental health improves. And it's a really rewarding and beautiful process to see. And today, again, is all about that as we get down to more specific examples. So meaning making and sense of mission. And here we go to another famous Jewish psychologist, Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning. The idea is similar. The idea of if you have a mission, it's also called narrative therapy. If you believe in a story, that there's a beginning, a middle, and an end, that everything that you go through, all of your suffering, all your trials and tribulations are meant to strengthen you, are meant to give you a purpose. Not only will you feel better in the moment, but you'll accomplish so much in your life. This idea of making your life meaningful, finding meaning in everything you go through, finding meaning in the suffering. It's not toxic positivity. It's not saying everything is good and everything's for the best. It's a very thin line, not for today's talk. But meaning, and it came from Viktor Frankl, who you know, he's not just talking the talk, he's walking the walk, right? He was in the concentration camps, and he wrote Man's Search for Meaning, and this idea that people who are in terrible situations, terrible sorrows, they're in a hospital with illnesses. Again, they did a study. They went around to all the hospital beds, and they had them fill out those surveys, those questions. How would you rate your belief in God from 1 to 5? How much do you think that God is a benevolent God from 1 to 5, or whatever the scale was? And they looked at their outcomes. Not only were those people who had a more positive view of God better psychologically, and this is the really cool part, they're better physically as well. Their treatment outcome in their physical illnesses, they had better prognosis because of their belief in an all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-benevolent God. I put this picture and this phrase up only because it's meaningful to me. I was working with a young Jewish woman, an Orthodox married woman from Brooklyn. Nobody knows who she is. There's lots of people there. And she had a fear and anxiety of being attacked, whether physically or sexually, while walking in public, especially late at night. An extremely debilitating anxiety, not a general kind of normal anxiety that I'm sure many people feel, especially women, but to the point that she was having panic attacks, anxiety attacks. She could not do it. And she needed her husband, who God bless him, was very devoting and very caring in this area, and would meet her wherever she was and would walk her home. And she told me that, because I asked, and this is part of when I train therapists in this, in the intake process, that's your in, by the way. You could ask a question either verbally or if you do a written intake, can I ask you about religion and spirituality, or is religion and spirituality important to you in your life? Would you like to discuss it in therapy? You consent. You get consent. I never, ever, ever bring it up. I don't say, so, do you believe in God? You daven today? I don't say that. I wait for them to bring it up. And if they want to, I'm all ears. But you could get consent. And this woman told me that when she walks late at night, she says this phrase. She said the Hebrew version. Gam ki elech begeitz ha-mavos, lo ira ra ki atah imadi. As I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, made famous by Coolio, I fear no evil. That was just an old school reference, showing my age and my background. I fear no evil. So I asked her, you know, you say this verse over and over again as you walk home, obsessively, compulsively, and yet your anxiety doesn't go down at all. Like, you feel just as anxious, 10 out of 10 on the scale. Is it really working for you? And she thought about it. She didn't have an answer. She came back the next week in the next session, and she said, you know, I thought about what you said, and you're right. I don't really believe what I'm saying. Because I'm saying, Gam ki elech begeitz ha-mavet, as I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, lo ira ra, I will not fear evil, ki atah imadi, for you are with me. And yet she's terribly afraid. She was saying it probably as a ritualistic kind of compulsive behavior, but it wasn't really working for her. And it actually was very eye-opening for her, and in future sessions we did some work on her emunah bitachon, her faith and trust in God. And it helped her tremendously. More than all the other techniques, we did exposure response prevention, we did coping skills and deep breathing and mindfulness, we did thought disputation, irrational thoughts, and looking at the research and the studies, all that stuff, it didn't work. I didn't do somatic. I'm not a somatic therapist. Maybe I should have. Some people are saying you should have tried somatic. But this helped her a lot, that sense of purpose and meaning. And I believe there's no greater example in our tradition, in our Torah, in our Bible, than the story of Joseph. It's an unbelievable, powerful story to read. Sometimes I just read the Bible word for word with no commentary, no interpretation, if you could do it in the original Hebrew or you know, a translation. And the story of Joseph is just fascinating. I want to point out one important caveat that people don't realize. If you look at the role of God as a speaking part, my kids are in Jewish day schools, and they have plays, and they actually put on a performance of Joseph, the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Any Andrew Lloyd Webber fans in the house? And there's a narrator, right? Yes. Okay. Nice. There's a narrator part. There's a boy or a girl who plays a part of a narrator who really, he or she's kind of acting as like God in that play. What's interesting is that God, in the first half of the book of Genesis, plays a very active role. He's speaking to everybody all the time. Adam and Eve, don't eat from this tree. Why'd you eat from that tree? I told you not to. Noah, build the ark. I'm going to send a big flood. Abraham, go to the land of Israel. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Oh, I'm speaking to them. Dreams, even non-Jewish people, maidservants. Everyone gets a vision from God. God checks in on them. Hey, hop on a quick call. How's it going? Everything okay? Don't worry, it's going to be okay. Go down to Egypt, I'm going to be with you. Second half of the book, story of Joseph, not once. Not when he's thrown into the pit by his brothers. Not when he's taken down on the back of a camel to Egypt. Not when he's in the house of Potiphar. And not when he's framed and thrown in jail wrongfully. All those years, not once, look if you don't believe me, does God say to Joseph, I'm here with you, it's going to be okay, don't worry, reread the book and you come out on top. That would have been nice, right? In the play they have that. He didn't have that. So Joseph has to figure this out on his own. And for 22 years, he has to connect the dots and to find God and to see God's plan. All the way to the end of the story in chapter 50, the last chapter in the book of Genesis, after his father Jacob dies and his brothers come to him and they say, now we're really going to get it, right? Now that our father is dead, now you're really going to come after us for what we did. You're probably so mad at us and you're going to punish us. And Joseph says, don't you get it, guys? Not only am I not mad, but this was a good thing. Look what happened. Look what God did. He orchestrated all of these events in order to bring it to this one point. And he says this phrase, I love this phrase, this verse, V'atem chashavtem alai ra'ah Elokim chashava tova. You intended to be good, to be bad. It's true. You had bad intentions. You meant to harm me. And it came from a vicious, negative place, but God had other plans. God intended to be good. And not only does he absolve them of their crime, but more importantly for our purposes, he forgives them. He harbors no resentment. His family members did something cruel and horrible to him. And they never really apologized, by the way, ever, or say anything to him to acknowledge it. He, on his own, says, I forgive you in my heart. It wasn't you, it was all from God, and I see the plan. Can you imagine being able to do that? So many people in therapy are still holding on to resentment, to pain, sometimes from real abuse, unfortunately. God have mercy on their souls, right? Physical, emotional, sexual abuse from loved ones, family members, and they can't forgive them, and they can't let go. And I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying that those people even deserve it. But Joseph gives us a paradigm. He's the one who's able to show us, without God's help, how to connect the dots of every negative experience and say, in the Bible, man plans and God laughs. And if people could do that on an individual level and to see how everything that happens to us, if I, God forbid, miss a flight, I don't even want to say it, right? So hopefully it'll work out for the best somehow, some way. I'll get to stay here a little bit longer and enjoy some of the amazing speakers. It really looks amazing. I'm very jealous and just disappointed. I won't be able to hear everyone. Hopefully a future opportunity. Okay, and I'm not going to go through this whole slide right now in the interest of time, but Rabbi Dr. Jonathan Sacks, he has a title, Lord. And this is one of the articles that inspired me to write a book on Torah mental health. What's amazing about Rabbi Dr. Jonathan Sacks, of blessed memory, to say all of his titles, he published all of his work online for free. You can go onto his website and it's all there. His book is totally available. And he writes and he tags the different therapists. I'm not going to read it. I couldn't cut it down because his words are just so eloquent. But he talks about Joseph being the first psychotherapist and how Joseph was able to find meaning, to positive reframe, to use Seligman from positive psychology in his life. So these are the paradigms, the Bible narratives. Personally, I do love to look at these stories and even the verses in other sections and say, wow, God is speaking to me. He's showing me a path for myself, for my clients, of how to do this. So we have this treasure, and in religiously informed psychotherapy, or in just in our daily practice, the first two skills on the agenda are faith in God and meaning making. And these are just two examples of that. Okay, let's move on to mindful behavior. This is one of my favorite ones. So here we have one of the sources from Maimonides. We have a lot of sources from Maimonides. He was a doctor, a physician, so he gave us a lot of good Torah and mental health, Torah and scientific sources. So he speaks about prayer. We just prayed in this room a short while ago. It's hard to do, but we all try. One should clear their mind from all thoughts and envision themselves, that's more like a visualization, as standing in the divine presence. And therefore, and this is something that is not well practiced, one must wait a short while before praying in order to focus. Ladies and gentlemen, this is meditation. So many times, especially speaking as a Orthodox rabbi in an Orthodox synagogue, we're missing out on this amazing skill and this amazing asset in our tradition, which is meditation. Meditation is very trendy, very widespread in the secular world. Many top CEOs of companies practice meditation as part of their daily routine. And yet, for some reason, Judaism and meditation, although I know there are other retreats, I don't know if JLI has a Jewish meditation retreat, but there are many, many organizations that are now promoting Jewish meditation. Rabbi Ari Kaplan wrote a book, Jewish Meditation. But in the mainstream, kind of run-of-the-mill Jewish practice, most people would not refer to their tefillah, their davening, their prayer, as meditation. And I would argue that when done properly, right, with kavana, with intent, with mindfulness, it very much is a meditative experience. So again, one of the concrete, tangible techniques that someone could practice either on their own or with the help of a professional is engaging in the religious behavior that they're already doing mindfully, right? That's what I do. I don't give them new activities always to do. I say, what do you do? What's in your daily routine? What are some things that make you feel like nothing else in the world matters? When you're involved in this activity, you're fully present, you're fully there. And people say things like painting, drawing, music, dancing, sports, running, even cooking, cleaning, learning. Rarely do they say prayer. Rarely do they say, when I'm praying, my mind is fully present and nothing else in the world matters. And that's a shame, because that's really what it's designed to do. So prayer is the first and foremost, I believe, opportunity to engage in mindful behavior. I'm not giving a lot of sources on mindfulness, what it is and how it works, but I can't say trust me, because I'm all about sources, but if you do your research, you'll see that mindfulness is very powerful, very effective, and very easy to learn and to master. Some other examples of making blessings, right? In Jewish practice, this is a cool one, where we have this tradition, this mitzvah, right? It's all about mitzvot, meat, mental health, to make a blessing before we eat. That's called mindful eating. Again, it's promoted in other organizations or other cultures kind of are doing a better job at this than we are, of mindful eating. I worked with a devout religious Catholic in my internship, and when she ate lunch and she said grace, oh, it put me to shame. The way I was trying to mumble, I didn't want her to see, I didn't want her to know. She's gonna think I'm like this, I have voices, I'm talking to myself, I just covering my mouth, looking at my phone, quickly is mumbling as fast as possible. No, she closed her eyes, put her hands together, spread them over the food, and really contemplated on what she's about to do. She's about to nourish her soul. That was beautiful. I still don't do it like that, but I should, and we all should. We should try. It actually improves the enjoyment of the experience. We notice the textures and the flavors of the food better, and if someone is trying to eat more healthfully, it actually improves our satisfaction from the meal and decreases cravings and hunger, because mindless eating mindlessly could be a bad habit. Okay, other quick examples. I call Shabbos Yom Shekulo mindfulness, right? Yom Shekulo on Shabbos, and this is a beautiful thing. And again, I'm jealous of everyone who gets to experience Shabbos here in this wonderful resort, to be fully there, fully present. Whatever is happening right before you light the candles, when you light those candles, it's done, it's over. The email, you have to send it later. The work meeting, the work call, the doctor's call, everything has to be turned off, put away. All we have is right now. You can't even talk or plan for after Shabbos, after the Sabbath, on Shabbos. You can't. It's like it doesn't exist. No, we're not going anywhere Saturday night. No, we're not. We're not driving. We're not flying. We're staying right here. We're not packing. We're not talking about it. All we have is now. That's mindfulness. We have that gift. It's in the Torah. It's the bread and butter of Judaism. Okay, senses, I have something I'll talk about now. Acting with intent, being present. Let's do a quick sense thing. You could also do this with Havdalah, but I like to choose something topical. It's, you know, in my mind, anyone who works for a synagogue, the high holidays are right around the corner. So Sukkot, a festival in the fall. I have a post about this on my Instagram account, and I've done actually exercises in schools. Schools have brought me in to do mindful, Jewish schools, mindful activities with their students, using the Dalet Medim, using the or whatever is relevant to that time of year. So look at this, right? I put some sources up here, right? If you're familiar with the different species and what body part they represent, the lulav is the spine, the aravot are the lips, the hadassin, the myrtle branches are the eyes, right? And the citron, the etrog, the hardest commandment to keep, the heart, yes, thank you, is to not smell the etrog. I know people know this. You're not supposed to smell the etrog on Sukkot. It's like a object for a mitzvah. It's dedicated for a holy purpose. I find that's the hardest thing to keep. I have to smell. You're supposed to make a blessing as well. So we could actually do a mindful experience using our five senses, or even the sixth sense of posture, of body movement, with the Dalet Minim, with the four species, right? Either while performing the mitzvah or just afterwards when the mitzvah is already finished, to think about something you see, taste something with your lips. They all have taste and smells, right? We talk about the dates, et cetera. So that's just an example of how we could integrate Jewish practice, mitzvot, into our mental health and our mental well-being. Take advantage of these opportunities. It's right there. 7-8 days of Sukkot, we have opportunity every day when we make the blessing or we perform the mitzvah. It's not just a ritualistic, perfunctory act. It's therapy. It's therapeutic. God has given us the recipe, and hopefully more and more people are aware of the opportunities in front of them to take advantage of every mitzvah of every day. Some other, if you're familiar with CBT and DBT, if you're a therapist or if you've been to therapy, people have been to therapy, especially for many years, know way more about therapy than perhaps many therapists, and definitely the general public, right? I have many clients who've been to therapy for many years, and they know all the terms and the techniques and all the ideas. It gives me a lot of nachas, a lot of joy. So here we have some fascinating sources. And look at Maimonides, the Rambam. Look what he says. If you have melancholia, if you have depression, if you're in a bad mood, I just did this morning. I was up at 4 a.m., right? Strolling through the gardens, you know, listen to music. We call it behavior activation, right? Do something pleasant, something pleasing in a deep way, in a spiritual way. We have a Rashi, a commentator on the Bible. He says, take deep breaths, right? They had the shortness, Ruach Sarah, they had shortness of breath. And Rashi explains, because they're in distress, they're in fight or flight, they're in trauma, they couldn't breathe deeply and properly. Deep breathing right there. I'll skip the next one and the last one, which is a really fascinating topic in and of itself. Any DBT, any dialectical behavior therapist? Okay. So very nice. So dialectics. This is Judaism 101, right? Elu ve'elu. Two different sides. There's no truth. It's perspective, right? It's the way you see it. We call that in therapy. There's no absolute truth. It's just, as a therapist, we have to understand the other person's perspective, even if we don't agree with it, even if it's honestly horrible and against all of our values. We have to validate them. We have to understand where they're coming from. We have to have a perspective of the other side. And that is Beit Shammai, Beit Hillel. That is the academies. That is Gemara. That is learning. Rashi, Toto, all the commentators, they all have different opinions. I'm Sephardi, Ashkenaz, Hasidim, right? People ask me, how could it be there's multiple truth? How come you're allowed to eat rice on Passover and your wife's family is not because she's Ashkenaz? I said, well, who's right? Who's wrong? They're both right. DBT in modern therapy, there's like a new wave, a new idea. Like, oh, we should teach people how to have multiple perspectives, a dialectic. Judaism says, we invented that. We've been doing that since the beginning of time, right? That's the beauty of Torah and mental health. Rational think, I over-prepared. I did too much. I try to put as much as I can. I'm giving you the highlights. We'll have to continue another time, but quickly, rational, logical, cognitive thinking, not falling into the hands of the thinking traps, as I call them, cognitive distortions, right? A very cognitive therapy technique as a basis, right? You know, Ellis, et cetera. Beck, look what the Rambam says again. By the Rambam is a treasure chest. It's a gold mine for psychology sources, right? He says, don't be overly emotional. Don't be overly, don't let your emotions take over you, right? Wise mind, of a piece there, another DBT term. And here we have a selection of some unhelpful thinking styles of thinking traps that therapists will educate clients in of how they're using irrational thinking. The Rambam was a rationalist, right? And Judaism very much values and promotes cognitive, you know, rational thinking. Okay, just another idea. Miscellaneous, and then we'll wrap up. Gratitude, you could have a whole class just on gratitude. That was one of the options we had for today. Volunteer work. I'll say one last thing about sense of community. This is very, very important, and I'll have to end. The next slide is questions anyway. Sense of community, I believe this is the most powerful protective factor that we have in the Jewish community. I know it as a member of the clergy. Judaism very much values community. You can't have Judaism without a community. One of the first things people do when they join a new neighbor, they move, is where's the Chabad house? Right? Who's the local Chabad rabbi? Where's the shul? Everything happens through the shul. People take care of each other. As long as you're connected to a synagogue or a Jewish organization, you will never be alone you will never be left alone. Okay, the rabbis and the people there, not only will you have casual social acquaintances who you could see and talk to and get connected with things, but there will be people there to take care of you when you need help. And I think out of all the benefits of religion, perhaps one could argue that the social network, the social support we have from the Jewish community is the strongest and has helped us overcome all of our adversity in our collective journey, our collective story, when we find the meaning and the purpose. And hopefully, I have to say Mashiach, bring a Mashiach one day very soon. Thank you so much for attending, participating. I hope you enjoyed.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.